Tonkin.
Hello, Bruce. It's Glenn. And
hi, Glenn.
You spoke with me, Vincent Chavigny.
Ah, good.
Since he's in the same region, we do the call together.
Is he from Monaco, I thought?
That's right, yes. And he lives in Antibes, which is very nearby.
Right, good. And the call yesterday, have you got any minutes or summary of that?
They're coming up, Bruce.
Oh, good,
okay. I've nearly finished them.
That's excellent.
I'm also doing...
Brilliant. I haven't had a look at the copy of your minutes from the Who Is call. I think I'll just let Marlon have a look at those.
Okay, that's fine. They're finished. That's all that worries me. I'm also
the minutes from yesterday's call are probably more important.
Yes, no, that's fine.
Hello, Glenn. It's Ken Stubbs. How are you?
Hello, Ken. Fine. How are you?
I'm fine.
Good morning, Ken. Bruce Tonkin here as well.
Hello there, Bruce. I did not receive any notification of the phone number or anything like that. Fortunately, Steve Metallis had it. So, Glenn, I need to find out if I'm on that list to make sure we don't
work. You are on the list, Ken.
Okay. For some reason,
I don't know why some people seem to get them and some don't.
Yeah. Because I usually have no problems. I get the invitations for the other conferences. This Conference Bridge is a great concept, too. I like this.
Yeah.
Teleconnection.com. It's a...
Ken, did you get the council conference?
Yes, I did.
Good.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I did. What do you want to take this today, Bruce?
Pretty much the same as on the transverse call, which is basically to just get an understanding of the process from here and have a little bit of a discussion about the core... recommendations from the Who Is report, in other words, reference those documents that I've previously sent around, and then ask people to get comments in by probably the same time next week. I think a kind of a weekly call is probably sufficient.
I don't know whether anyone else is on the call yet or not. Here comes somebody.
Requested.
Good morning, Rick. It's Bruce Tonkin here, and I also have Ken Stubbs and Glenn, and also Vince from Name Bay.
Cool. Afternoon, everyone.
Good evening, Vince.
Have an agenda, Bruce?
Not really, Rick. I'm a bit meeting overload at the moment. But the basic agenda really is to just run through the process or agree on the process for the rest of the month, and then to just briefly reference the documents that I sent round, which I guess are the summary of the recommendations of the task force in the area of accuracy and bulk access, just drawing people's attention to the key points there, getting any quick feedback from people, but primarily what I intend to do is to ask people to comment specifically on each recommendation and indicate whether it's feasible to implement and what the implementation issues would be.
Gotcha.
Hi, Bruce. This is Donna. I just joined.
Good morning.
Hi, this is Alana. I just joined.
Good morning, Alana.
Hi, this is Margie, and I've just joined.
Okay, great, Margie. Just waiting a few more minutes just for a few more people to join. And if you're there, Glenn, if you could just check the mailing list and just see that there aren't people that are missing the teleconference details. I'm not actually online at the moment.
Okay, fine. Shall I send the teleconference details to the list?
I have a feeling people didn't. A lot of people didn't get it.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll send them to the list.
See, I got three emails from you, Bruce. All three of them referred to the past tense, assuming that we had received the invitation. But
yeah, that's right, yeah.
Rick, how did you get the number, Rick?
I got it.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't have any problem.
Tim Ruiz just joined the call.
Thanks, Tim. Bruce Tocken and the cast of many so far. We're just waiting for a few more people to join, and then we'll get started.
Hi, this is Steve Mahalovich with Network Solutions. Just want to let you know I'm on the call.
Thanks, Steve. Welcome.
Good to be here.
Nice to hear the Network Solutions brand again.
Very, very exciting for us over here.
Yes, that's good. Okay, I think we'll get started then. I think we have enough on the call to get going. Firstly, just to sort of run through the purpose of the committee. The committee at the Names Council meeting in Amsterdam in December, there was discussion on the Who is Task Force report, and it was decided that there were, I guess, two issues really. The first issue was just getting clarity on what the actual recommendations for consensus policy were. There were many things in the Who is report, many ideas, many suggestions for further work. But the actual recommendations where there are new obligations on either ICANN or registrars or registry were actually comparatively few. And there was a lack of understanding, I think, in the community in the sense that there was a feeling that there were many radical changes being suggested when in actual fact a detailed reading of the report indicates that only a few recommendations for consensus policy were actually in the report. And by consensus policy, I mean that policies that will eventually become contractually binding for registrars and registries. So the intent of this committee is to, one, look at those actual recommendations for consensus policy that are in the task force report, to determine whether those recommendations are feasible to implement. And by feasible, I mean that they are either technically feasible and also feasible within a legal framework. And part of that relates to enforcement as well, in that we do need to make sure that we can objectively determine whether or not a registry or a registrar is complying with the changes to the recommendations, and for that matter, a registrar, whether they are indeed complying with the requirements of those recommendations. So the timeline from here, we have 1 month to complete an implementation report. This will go to the GNSO Council in February with the intent that the implementation report will be appended to the Who is Task Force report, and the combination of the recommendations plus the implementation report would be input for the ICANN board, and if the ICANN board signs off on it, then it would become a binding policy for registries and registrars. The steps as I see it from here, and I'll post a summary of this to the list when I get a moment, is that we have effectively 3 weeks from here to complete the work. As I say, the number of actual recommendations is quite small. What I would seek is that each of the registries and registrars on this call look at those recommendations, and the ones that relate to registrars, I think there's only about four, comment on whether they are feasible. If they're not feasible, what the implementation issues are, and if it's easy potentially to suggest some changes or improvements to the wording of the recommendations to make them feasible. If we can get all those comments to this mailing list, the implementation committee mailing list, by the end of next week, then we can have a conference call at the same time next week to go through those comments. Following that, we would be seeking to create a draft document which summarises all of that input by the following week, so by the, I guess, the middle of January.
Sorry, this is Tony Harris, joining.
Thank you, Tony. It's Bruce Tonkin. I'm just giving a summary, I guess, of where I see the timeline from here, in that I see the first week of our timeline is to analyse the recommendations and get each of the registries and registrars to provide input on whether the recommendations are feasible, what any of the implementation issues would be from either a technical or a legal standpoint, and that we get all those in to the mailing list by next week. We have a teleconference same time next week to go through those issues. The outcome of that teleconference, or the following week, would be to create a draft report. We then discuss that draft report in a teleconference the week following, and then finally, following that teleconference, we produce a final report. So I guess I see us meeting weekly by teleconference, but we need to be doing a lot of the work between those teleconferences. We also have on the committee representatives from the Who Is Task Force. We have Tony Harris. We have Thomas Rosler, who couldn't make it to the call today. And we also have
Steve
Metallis. Thank you, Steve.
Yes, and I'm here.
And the benefit of having the members of the Who Is Task Force on the call is that we, as registries and registrars, can seek clarification of the intent of a particular recommendation, because it may be that when we're trying to look at the implementation of it, we're not quite sure on what the intent is, and that may help us to determine the best implementation. So that's, I guess, a summary, and I guess I welcome input or comments from people on the call now.
Bruce, this is Solana. I think some of the items in the WHO's report were sort of open to misunderstanding, and I wonder if you or somebody else on the task force, as we go through each item, could just briefly explain what was meant, even if the meaning was fairly open to, you know, different interpretations.
Okay, have you seen the two documents that I sent, Solana?
Yes, I have. I still think that there's some things that I've heard some task force members say, oh, this wasn't necessarily meant to be the most onerous definition of, or you know, interpretation, but that certainly doesn't come through in the document, or at least causes some confusion. So that's why.
That's certainly the intent and the benefit of being able to do that. Yeah, I will go through that later in the call, Alana. So, are there any other comments?
This is Steve Metallis. I just had two questions. I think that the timetable sounds right. My only two comments are, first, if we could ask for everybody to send their comments in, say, 24 hours ahead of the next call, set that deadline, then everyone would have a chance to look at them, and there could be a lot of overlap and so forth, so I think that would make our call more efficient.
Yeah, and those comments can even be questions too, so that, Alana, when you come to review the requirements, if you've got specific questions, send them to the list, because the Who Is Task Force members may be able to clarify those on the list.
Right, and especially if they're sent in, you know, at least 24 hours in advance of the next call. And the other issue, which I guess we don't have to decide at this point, was at the second phase, there will be a draft document prepared. Who do you see preparing that document?
If anyone wants to volunteer, they're most welcome. But other than that, I think Glenn will certainly be available to keep track of the minutes of these teleconferences, and I'm certainly prepared to do my best to assure that the report gets produced, even if I have to draft it. But if anyone wants to volunteer, that'd be great. Any other comments? Okay, then if we just pick up Alana's suggestion there, and I'm actually just driving in a car at the moment on the way to work because it's relatively early in the morning here. But in the, if we look at the accuracy section, a lot of the comments under accuracy were really obligations on ICANN, and a lot of it is basically saying that ICANN needs to remind people of their responsibilities. ICANN needs to keep a website that lists the contacts for the registrars where whois queries can be sent, and ICANN should also have a complaints form on their website as a central collection point for the community if they wish to register a complaint. So rather than going through the ICANN obligations in detail on this call, because it's mostly registrars and registrars here, if we take the first recommendation that related to a registrar obligation, and that is basically that registrars must require registrants to review and validate all the WHOIS data upon renewal of a registration. And then it says the specifics of validation remain to be determined. Does anyone have any comments on that specific recommendation or issues that they'd like to raise?
Bruce, this is Rick Wesson. Having done some research into what validation may mean, I would be happy to post something to the list for people to think about as far as specifics for what validation may mean.
Yeah, it is actually quite a change in the business practices of many of the registrars and resellers, because often they have a very streamlined process for doing a renewal, which is pretty much along the lines of either insert your credit card here, or it's an auto-renew process where the reseller or registrar has the credit card on file, and unless the registrant says no, the name is automatically renewed.
Mm-hmm.
So this would actually be a step where presumably the registrar and reseller has an obligation to send some kind of reminder to the reseller with a copy of the current WHOIS data and say, is this right or is it wrong? If it's wrong, fix it. Is that roughly how you see it, Steve Patella?
Or that it's done perhaps online. I mean, you know, many registrars.
Oh, yeah, but just the mechanism of actually presumably
right.
requiring the person to look at the material in some way, whether it's via a letter or whether it's via a website, but before they actually commit to the renewal. Is that what you're seeking from a task force point of view?
This is Steve. I think, yes, that we're looking for some process that will increase the likelihood that if there's inaccurate data there that the registrar will correct it. Opportunity for registering to correct.
Steve, were you looking for, anything other than a sort of a prompter for the registrant to review their information again? In other words, is there a double check that the registrar needs to take?
Well, I think the registrar, you know, I think it would be worth talking in this group about what steps the registrar could take to try to increase the accuracy of it as Bruce said, there's a lot of different methods, I guess, that are now used in terms of renewals, but what steps could be taken to I mean, it's a good opportunity to try to clean up these problems with the database.
I guess my question is, you know, are we, for this particular item 11, are we talking about, you know, making sure the registrant sees the current WHOIS data and then in some way says, yes, it's still correct, and on he goes? Or are you looking for something beyond, were you expecting something beyond that when you talk about validate?
Well, we didn't have any discussion in the task force about that, but we use validate there, and in other places we use verified or having documentary evidence, documentation of the data, and it doesn't say that here, so I assume that this would be a lesser step, such as just doing whatever possible to encourage the registrant to condition the registrant's renewal on his at least having looked at this data and said, yes, this is accurate.
Right.
Yeah.
I think, could I step in, Tony Harris, here? I think in our discussions in the task force also, there was some mention that there might be some pieces of the information related to the registrant that could be double checked automatically, perhaps the email address or the IP server addresses.
Mm-hmm. I think that would be a more effective form of validation.
Well, I mean, not getting to the question of if he supplies a telephone number, the registrar would have to dial that telephone number and incur in expenses of time and telephone charges. Okay.
Yeah, validating an email address. I mean, I guess if we're going to talk about the individual pieces of data, then we get into a big topic because there's a lot of technical issues. Even validating an email address may sound like a simple, reliable thing you could always do, but it's not as reliable as you might think.
Yeah, I'm not sure what validating an email address is. Is it sending an email and getting a response back?
Pinging the domain of the email perhaps might be the most reliable part of it, but even that isn't necessarily 100%.
But it would be better than not doing anything, probably, in many cases.
But what do we do if it fails? I mean, then you get into this issue where, well, it failed, but the registrant still says it's okay. Do we let them go? Then if that's what we're going to do, why do it at all? You know, if we're going to ping it and we can't, and then we're going to tell the registrant, well, sorry, you can't renew because, you know, for some reason, maybe the email server's down or who knows what. So a lot of things to consider there, and we start doing that kind of thing.
Plus, every time we add complication to the registration process, there is growing potential for something going wrong and for people not actually being able to renew their name inadvertently, and then there's a host of problems associated with that.
Yeah, so what I think we should do then, because I just want to sort of move through these points rather than spend a lot of time on any one point then, those are the sort of the general issues I think we're coming up here, is that it's not clear to registrar or registries how much validation is required. What I suggest we do, if the registrar members of this call post what they think would be a reasonable thing to do to meet that recommendation, and then we can review that on the list. The next point, 12, was that when registrations are deleted on the basis of omission of false contact data, the redemption grace period should be applied. However, if somebody then tries to redeem the name through the redemption grace period, and presumably this is kind of along the lines of you've tried to contact the registrant, you get no reply, you try a few different methods, you get no reply, the domain name's causing a problem in some way, potentially it's involved in criminal activity or whatever, the name is deleted, and then the person that does own the name then comes back and says, actually, I want that name, then it's basically saying that at this point you must still correct the contact information before the name is made live. I think it's really just trying to cover a loophole that people can't use another process to get the name back again.
If I recall, it goes even deeper than that, and that's one of the things that I expressed concern about in the WHOIS meeting, and that is that there might be some sort of a burden placed on the registrar to validate the data in a case like you're describing. Now, you've used the extreme here,
but let's suppose that I'm trying to renew a name and somebody challenges the legitimacy of the WHOIS accuracy. I send an email out to Bruce Tonkin and it bounces, and we go through this process. The reason it bounces or is not, there's no response to it, it may very well be that Bruce is on vacation or something like this. We go into the 15-day process, and Bruce comes back, discovers the deal, and tries to resubmit a corrected email address or corrected address information, if that was the case. Now there's a burden on the registrar to have to authenticate the legitimacy of the changes that Bruce is making to the WHOIS file. That could put a significant burden on the process if we had to do that, and how do we deal with it until it's authenticated?
Yeah, I think that the critical word most registrars have password authentication to manage their account. So, Bruce would be able to log in and change and update his information. I don't see why that would be a problem.
Yeah, I think what Ken is saying is whether you verify the accuracy, I guess the problem here, you've got to deal with the normal case, and the normal case is that the person's just been out of contact or whatever, and they just log in, as you say. There are mechanisms that we have for people to authenticate themselves before we allow them to update their contact details. That's one thing, but the key word there is verified and what verified means, and I think that's a loaded word, and that occurs in the next recommendation as well, where it talks about documentary evidence.
That's what I'm referring to. Yeah. I guess I'm using authentication in a different context than just a pure technical context. To authenticate the data means that at some point in time there's an implication that the information that's being provided to correct the inaccurate data is in fact accurate and authentic and not just bogus all over again.
Well, it sounds like to me one of the things that would be beneficial for our group and beneficial for anyone that reads these documents is to write a glossary. Let's define these terms in the context that we think that they should be defined, and then we have a base to work from when we use these words, because it sounds like they're confusing to different people. They have different meanings.
I think that's a good point. This is Steve Metallics. But they are intended to be two different things. I mean, the situation in paragraph 11, there's no reason to doubt the contact data of this person. The person is renewing and should be given an opportunity to update and correct anything that's wrong. In the second situation, there's a new factor here, which is that, well, it could rise in a couple different ways, but let's take the case where a complaint has come in about false contact data. The registrar has attempted to contact the registrant, and there's been no response for some period of time. That's a situation that's different from the first situation, because at least there's some indication maybe that there's a problem with the contact data. Isn't definitive, but it's an indication. And so I think the idea here is that there should be some further checking that's done before new contact data is accepted. But exactly what that would entail, I think Rick's idea of saying validation means this and verification means that would be a good thing for this to try to tackle.
And furthermore, even defining what accuracy is. I think everyone has different ideas about that. And if we could all work from the same base, it might be beneficial. Bruce, I also have one other comment about 13, where the registrar send inquiries to registrants regarding the accuracy of their data under Clause 378 of the RA. There might be situations whereby the registrant speaks a different language than what the registrar is sending the email to.
So, sorry, this is in regard to 13. Which bit, Rick?
There might be potential language issues whereby a reseller has registered a domain. The reseller was using Turkish, and
right.
you know, the registrar uses English, and the registrar is sending these notifications out in English, and the registrant doesn't read English.
Okay, that's a valid implementation issue. I think that's something we need to capture. It's partly something that's been in discussion in the transfers area as well, and that often when people are being asked to authenticate a transfer message, that is occurring in a language that they don't understand, and we're sort of dealing with some of those issues there as well.
So
I think another issue in 13 that will be an implementation issue is the documentary proof, obviously, because defining what
yes,
that
I think
is.
This is the thing that had a great deal of concern to most registrars, I think. And this partly, I think, comes down to, are we talking about one field of data being incorrect? Like, for example, let's say the mailing address, postal mailing address and everything is correct, but the email address is wrong. To me, that's a pretty simple process of the person updating their email address, whereas the other scenario is where nothing is correct and it's clearly fraudulent, so that the mailing address is listed as Santa at the North Pole and the email address is clearly something that doesn't exist because the main name associated with that email address doesn't exist. So I guess the burden of proof varies a bit depending on whether the data is clearly fraudulent or whether it's just a stale piece of data. In other words, it's a real address, but the person no longer is located at that address.
The whole idea of verifying postal addresses is sticky anyway, especially given 15 days that we've got. I mean, a lot of times I can see where it just gets down to, you know, one word against the other. Well, the registrant insists it's a correct address. Somebody insists it's not. And the time it would take to verify it by actually, you know, mailing and getting a response, or do we allow someone to send, you know, ask for copies of their utility bills, or, you know, I guess I get a little lost on how we would verify that.
I think 15 days. Bruce, go ahead.
Well, can I just comment that the 15 days is how long they have to respond. It's not how long it takes you to analyze the data. And the 15 days is actually in the contract already. So we just separate the 15-day issue. That's kind of already in the contract. And it's really just saying that the person must respond within 15 days. I think the real issue is the words must be accompanied by documentary proof of the accuracy. Because one, we have issues of this is a global service, so different countries have different standards for documents. Within the US law, you might have a particular type of document that can be used of somebody like a, I'm not sure the terminology is in the US. In Australia, we talk about a justice of the peace, but we have certain people that are typically signed passport applications and so forth.
Bruce, I think one of the big problems with this particular paragraph is that registrars have no capacity to determine proof. So registrars have no way to verify that something is provided by an authority that they can determine. In the United States, when you show a driver's license to go into a bar, there's a book that someone can look at to verify that your driver's license looks like the driver's license from that state, because there's 50 different styles. When we look at documents from a global perspective, there's no way for us to verify that some kind of driving document from another country is valid and not forged.
In fact, if I could sort of back up what Rick is saying, it's Alana again. To my knowledge, Dun & Bradstreet does this sort of validation only at sort of a higher level of its accuracy check. That even D&B's very basic standard check of a new business doesn't include any kind of documentary proof. It's only if you sign up to be one of their higher member I don't know what they call it, but in any case, you would be asking for registrars to do something more than this business accuracy authority does today.
Under this paragraph, we're being asked to do it for the entire world population.
Yeah, Bruce, would you put me in the queue, please?
Yes, Tony Harris.
Who was that? So that was Ken, was it?
Yes.
So I had Ken Stubbs and Tony Harris. I might go with Tony Harris first because I think I'd want to hear just a bit of a Who Is Task Force view on what the expectation was here. I think what you're hearing clearly is there are implementation issues from a registrar's point of view of just what is the document that you're looking for, and what we're looking for is some kind of objective test here, something that's not subject to subjectivity. Can you comment, Tony Harris?
Yes. Well, first of all, it's true that we're looking at the entire world population, as was said just now, but then I believe that these are cases of we have a problem in hand, right? It's not every single registration you have to do this with, and clearly these would be people who have proven to supply inaccurate data, and this is why this is now being required from them. And there must be some way we can come up with simple solutions, like, well, you can send a telephone bill which says that the phone you have listed on the Whois data is actually, there's a bill for this and it belongs to me or to my company. Simple things like that. Even if it comes from another country, that should be better than nothing.
Bruce, if I could get in the queue, this is Tim.
And Rick Wesson also.
Okay, Ken Stubbs.
Yeah, well, as I was on the task force and as I tried to point out, that's not an easy thing. First of all, it's not quite as easy as it sounds. Number one, Tony, you've made an assumption that you said clearly this person has provided inaccurate data. Not necessarily the case at all, because in some cases, as I pointed out in the task force meeting, it took 25 days for a mail to reach my home address from Shanghai. And many of the registrars are dealing in venues all over the world. So how am I, if I'm register.com or GoDaddy or one of the other places, supposed to ascertain the accuracy of a telephone bill from the Nippon Telephone Company for a Japanese registrant? What you're doing is injecting in the process an element of uncertainty and also a significant element of expense, because now you're putting a human being in the middle of a lot of this process, and many of the registrars, the margins are such that your cost becomes prohibitive. And the other thing I'm concerned about is that this could be left open. There's always the possibility that there could be abuse of the process that questions this data to begin with. And like I said before in the task force meeting, I couldn't read an Athens telephone directory to ascertain whether an address is correct or not. So
you have a point. Undoubtedly, you have a point. But I don't think we're deciding right now exactly what the documentary proof will be. We're just throwing ideas around, right?
Right. Well, that's the point I was trying to make, and that is that there was not necessarily clarity as how to deal with these issues behind some of the recommendations.
Yeah, I think what we probably want, and again, I don't want to spend too much time on any one point, but what I suggested, rather than getting too tied up with the documentary proof, why don't we get registrars just to propose what they would see, something that is implementable, which may not even involve documents, but just what they would suggest as an approach where somebody has provided data that on face value looks fraudulent, and what processes that they recommend using to get that data corrected. And it might just simply be a case that you at least have a visual check of the information by human to see whether it does, on face value, look real, and that's probably about the most you could do. Okay, if we then go on to... So those are really the three recommendations, 11, 12, and 13, that relate to accuracy. And I think there are obviously some issues that have been raised on each of those, and I just ask each registrar in the next before the next call next week to, one, raise issues that they might have, but two, to really suggest what they would see being an appropriate implementation of the intent of the recommendation. I think we understand the intent of the recommendation is that the when the registrant responds that the data is correct. The next area is bulk access, and the recommendation that relates to registrars is really just a single sentence, and that is that registrars modify their access agreements to eliminate the use of data for marketing purposes. And one way of doing that from the legal text point of view is to say that a registrar's access agreement shall require the third party to agree not to use the data to allow, enable or otherwise support any marketing activities regardless of the medium used, and such media include, but not limited to, email, telephone, fax, postal mail, SMS and wireless alerts. So again, just throw it open to people or registrars particularly to comment or seek clarification on that recommendation.
This one, I guess I'll start. This is a topic that's been near and dear to our heart for a long time, and what we've been learning recently is that bulk is only half the story, and that there's even greater abuse, or at least we're starting to see greater abuse in the port, who is port 43 and public, who is, where marketers are coming in, taking data without even our knowledge, and then doing the same thing that has caused the bulk problem. Our DROA case is a case in point, a recent case in point. So I want to throw out there whether there's an opportunity here to consider the two together.
Bruce, this is...
I think not. I think that the purpose of this particular committee is to deal just with the bulk access. However, the WHOIS task force itself is looking to create an issues report for future work. And what I'd suggest you do there, Alana, is send your comments regarding the Port 43 WHOIS to the WHOIS task force itself, because they would use that in creating their issues report. I've just realised that there was a queue before, and I should probably go back to it. Tim Ruitz, you had some comments on...
That's fine, Bruce. I think Ken pretty well summed up what I was thinking, and so that's fine. Well, I'll just wait to submit my comments and things.
Okay, and Rick Weston, you were also on the queue before?
Oh, yeah, but I'm okay.
Yep, great. Okay, so back onto this topic. So, Alana, I think the purpose of this committee is to deal with the recommendations on the table which relate to bulk access. I think you could certainly say from an implementation issue point of view, you could say that the recommendation will probably not have the full effect that it perhaps was intended by the task force, because there are other ways of getting the information without going through bulk access.
Yeah, I will take it further. I would be worried that people who would have otherwise used bulk access for the same issues may move even more to using Port 43 or public who is to obtain customer information.
Well, I think that's an important issue. So that will actually shift in a way the load onto the main systems.
And also with obtaining the information through public Port 43, there aren't the restrictions that one has with bulk access.
Well, there are no restrictions. Yes. Yeah. But if we just deal with this point on its own, Alana, do you agree with the principle, at least, that the principle is that the bulk access agreement should not include the ability to market through any of those media? When I think, from my point of view, that I see that we can more or less agree to this principle. Is I don't think there is an implementation issue on bulk who is itself. I think what we're saying is that it raises an issue for Port 43 access in two ways. One is it can bypass this recommendation, and two, it can increase the traffic load on registrar and registry systems.
Yeah. And Bruce, I think those are implementation issues.
I agree, Rick. Sorry, go ahead, Lana.
No, I'm sorry. I'm not sure that where we're coming out on this. If we're all kind of agreeing those are implementation issues, is that sort of a note for the record of this committee?
I guess if we're making a consensus statement here, then I'd like to chime in. I don't see a problem with it. I would rather that we take steps to do what's right with Boku is and not miss that opportunity now because there's a problem with port 43. And then later we can address that issue, and hopefully we will. But I wouldn't want to miss this opportunity now to tighten up the way bulk access is used just because there still remains a problem with port 43.
Yeah, I think this is just expressing a personal view. But from a personal view, I think if this is accepted as a recommendation by the GNSO Council and the ICANN board, then it's establishing a precedent. And from that precedent, we can then start looking at port 43, who is. So I think we've got to sort of make small steps rather than just try and solve everything at once. But certainly I think the issues that Alana's raised and Rick's raised, we should include in the report on the implementation of that recommendation. In other words, it is an implementation issue and needs to be thought about.
I think you're saying this, but just to double check, is if we go ahead and agree to the bulk issue at this point, but note, even in this committee, the grave concerns with other types of WHOIS and how those concerns might even grow as we shut down bulk WHOIS.
Yes, agreed, yeah. Okay, any other comments on this recommendation?
Yeah, this is Margie. I think I'd like to have a definition as to what marketing activities is. I don't, or maybe you can answer the question. Is that already addressed somewhere in the contract?
No, it's not. I was hoping no one would ask that question because it was certainly discussed on the WHOIS Task Force call. Again, I think we're trying to establish a principle here. The wording marketing activities is, again, already in the contract in that wording is already there. I think I can't recall the exact clause, but there is clause that uses the same terminology in the existing contract, and no, it's not defined anywhere.
Right, because only my concern would be is that people can interpret it a different way than it may be interpreted, because it says any marketing activity, so...
Yes.
You could actually find people in violation of this when, it's not, in accordance with the intent of the committee. Or the task force, and so it'd be interesting to see if anyone believes we should give some guidance as to what marketing activities means.
I think if you were to ask individuals, they'd tell you that anything that where you're going to use my personal information or contact me without my prior approval is a marketing activity.
Specifically for a solicitation.
Right, and I think there's a U.S. statute, I believe, about that, telephone solicitation. So, I know at least in the government, they've come up with definitions on, what that means, like what spamming is and all, and unsolicited, telephone solicitations. So there is a way of doing that if that's something that we feel is important.
Would that include, polls and nonprofit?
It should.
Yeah. A solicitation is a solicitation, whether it comes from a nonprofit, a poll, or a marketing effort from a corporation.
So by solicitation, though, we're meaning that it may not mean a solicitation for money. So right. Someone was just giving the example of a poll, so they could say, do you like cornflakes? Yes or no. Well, that's... still, I guess, a marketing activity because you're collecting market data there.
Yeah, as we discussed in the task force, it's something that's going to have to be clarified. And I think that we'd be better off to get the clarification now because I'd hate to see a circumstance where somebody down the road who was precluded from doing it argued that someone like
Thompson & Thompson or LexisNexis or someone else fell under the definition because the definition was so broad. So if you're going to keep me from doing it, you got to keep them from doing it.
Well, it sounded like, Margie, do you want to have a go at drafting some words what you know from other U.S. law that you think is appropriate there?
Yeah,
but I think we can have some suggestions because I think it is an important issue, and perhaps I note the wording that's in 3.3.5 in the contract says enable the transmission of unsolicited commercial advertising or solicitations to entities other than the data recipient's own customers. So it's really talking about solicitations there.
Yeah. Bruce, this is Steve Mahalovich. I've been silent, but I'm just trying to get up to speed on this. Would it make sense to possibly define it as what it actually can be used for, which would seem like a smaller arena than everything that it cannot be used for?
Yeah, it certainly. I had a discussion with members of the task force yesterday, I think, or the day before, and the comment there was that it's the concept of you can define a blacklist saying this is what you can't use it for, or you can define a whitelist and say this is what you can use it for. I think both are difficult to do. And I think the approach that they took was to sort of use a blacklist approach and say you can't use it for marketing. And so that would... So I don't know. I mean, I think you can do it either way. If you've got a way of specifying it, what it can be used for, and everyone agrees on that, then that's great.
Okay.
But either way, I think if people can have a go at putting some text, that might help. Again, I'll put it back to the members of the WHOIS task force, whether they had any further comments on what the meaning of this particular phrase is, marketing activities. Tony Harris or Steve Vitalis?
That sounds reasonable.
This is Steve. I think Bruce, your reference to what is already in the agreement is important because that gives a sense of what was prohibited or not entirely. Basically, what we're trying to do with this recommendation is to prohibit some types of activities that were sort of partially prohibited under the existing contract. There's a lot of loopholes in the existing contract. And some of those have led to litigation, such as the Register.com versus Vireo litigation. And we did try to, and there was discussion about coming up with the so-called whitelist. We thought it might be easier to do the blacklist, but I recognize that marketing activities is not defined in the agreement now. Either, I mean, there's other terms that are not defined here that probably could be usefully defined, such as bulk access, which is not defined. But I think it would be a useful implementation exercise to try to get more specific about what ought to be covered here. But I think it is a very difficult task, and even there's a reference to the U.S. law. U.S. law is not very satisfactory on this either, because, for example, it does exclude non-commercial solicitations. So
it does what, sorry?
It excludes non-commercial solicitations. They're not covered
okay.
by the telemarketing rule. So
right.
it's a tough problem, but I think any insights that this group can offer could be very constructive.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the one, just again reading through the contract, there's two references here. 3.6.3 uses the term unsolicited commercial advertising, and then it says or solicitation to entities other than the party's own customers. So that second phrase pretty much covers the non-commercial stuff as well. And then in 3.3.6.6, it just uses the term... registered name holders may elect not to have their personal data available for bulk access for marketing purposes. So that's where the marketing purposes is referenced twice in that clause of the contract, but not defined anywhere. So we're not getting any worse in terms of openness, but I guess what we're saying, it would be better if we could improve on the wording to make it easier to implement. So I think what we do is if the members of this call can perhaps suggest some alternative wording which they think can define those, you know, define the term more clearly. And I think if we can get some text from people like Alana and others on on the implementation issues that relate to Port 43 if this recommendation is accepted.
Okay, now on Port 43, you just want the sort of recognition language, is that what you're saying? Sort of we recognize the problems caused by that sort of thing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, that's pretty much all I really wanted to cover in this call, which is really to go through those recommendations, get people thinking about it. But if those that have spoken on this call could commit themselves to writing in the next few days, and I think we're only talking about four recommendations all up, it's not that difficult, and then we can discuss the wording and the issues raised in the next call, which I think I'll make same time next week to keep it simple. What I'll do is I'll post to the list a timeline and just clarify the purposes of the group. Any other final comments anyone would like to raise? Okay, at that point then we'll close off the call and I thank everyone for their time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce.